Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Last week when we left off, it's already three after. I'm negligent. We were talking about what enemies are, what they look like, and whether we can make them automatic in our lives, particularly without thinking of that, and whether our enemies change over the years or the days or the minutes, and why are we assuming that a lot of people or classes of people are going to be enemies. And I use the word enemies advisedly. The author uses it. I prefer any of six dozen other words, but he's because when we start thinking about somebody as a foe or an adversary or a combatant or a, better yet, a co-collaborator or something, we get out of enemy thinking. But I think enemy thinking is endemic in being whatever we are today. I don't know whether this is fully human or whatever. Okay. First slide, please, 34. You probably can't read that, but I will tell you it is an article I clipped off the internet about a Washington Nationals fan who was at Houston for the World Series, game six or seven, I forget.
Seven.
Okay, and he talked about how polite and good-natured the fans in Houston were, and what a surprise that was. Because he, my point being, he was kind of automatically assuming he, a Washington fan at Houston, would be the enemy. Don't you hate air quotes? But he found he wasn't the enemy. And I don't know how. Can you read that? It's not really necessary to read every part of it. If you can read it, fine. If not, I've made my point. But he ended up saying it was an honor to be a guest in Houston. And he did not expect that at all. He thought he was in the enemy camp. We tend to assume in sports that the enemy is the other team. Even if we're the ones in the red uniforms this week and we'll be in the blue uniforms next week, it's always going to be the people in the other uniform. They're going to be the enemy somehow. I think that's the kind of thinking we have to get rid of. Also, there's been a lot of fuss and bother about harassing referees. Now, being one, I will tell you it's not nearly as bad, at least in Iowa, as it seems to be some places. Because I've only gotten hit once, and that was by a guy the county attorney's office told me is just nuts and there's no point in prosecuting him because he's in jail most every weekend. So I forgave him and let him go. I mean, I haven't seen him again, but I went, okay, fine. That just came out of thin air. And there's good-natured ribbing. Hey, Blue, you want to borrow my glasses? Or stuff like that. Okay. But it's rarely around here, excuse me, around here it's rarely mean-spirited. Once in a while it is, and every referee learns to just ignore it. But once in a while, I ended up representing an umpire who had been slugged by a football player-sized 12-year-old ball player. Who just came up after the game and slugged him. And the Little League thought, not our fault. Everybody immediately said, not our fault. But don't blame the kid either. And then you may have seen the story in the Register, on TV and in the Register, recently where a referee in, I think it was Lincoln versus Dowling, but it doesn't matter, football referee, was assaulted by a kid and then his parent during a game. And to my horror, the spokesperson for the Des Moines Public Schools said, well, let's look to see if the referee was at fault. Needless to say, I didn't react to that well. But all in there somewhere is the assumption either that it's not my fault or that it's somebody else's fault, or maybe that it's nobody's fault and we have to live with this. I disagree. I don't think we do. Let's go to the next slide, which is 35, please. Okay. By the way, do I have the year right on that, Tammy?
I don't know. Could be
close? Okay, yeah. Tammy is descended from Reverend John Sargent, who was a missionary to the Stockbridge Indians and built a mission around 1733 that eventually became this great house that's still standing as a museum. And it's interesting for her to walk in there and touch things that John Sargent used and wrote with and handled that long ago. He went to the Indians. Now these were not known, the Stockbridge Indians were not known as a band that was automatically going to try to tomahawk any white people. But they were still Indians, and they lived on the frontier, and we were still white people. And he managed to not only make friends with them, but become a living part of their heritage. But they distrusted him, of course. And if he didn't distrust them, he has probably more Christian something or other than I do. Because if I were moving to Western Massachusetts, when there was nothing there but Indians and trappers and not much else, I would assume he distrusted them. And they had to work through that. The question that I find in some literature is that we have to earn someone's respect, which begs the question, how do we become enemies? Why don't we give them respect immediately? And then now, what has changed, if anything? Have we evolved into a bunch that can give respect automatically, perhaps until it's unearned? That's hard to do, but that's what I try to do. Respect is always the start of relationships, and I said something about the golden rule last week. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. He, John Sargent, set an example of respecting them. And they came to respect him, and the two communities intermingled. And by the way, the reason we're interested in this is that they may have intermingled to the possibility that one of Tammy's great-great-grandmothers was an Indian, but we can't find out. That, however, is why we went to the Stockbridge Muncie. Next slide, please.
This one?
Whichever one's in order. In the order. Yeah, the Indian fighters. Top right. There. This is how we white folks thought of the Indians in 1733. Those are Indians fighting us, attacking us. However, next slide. Oops. Depending on whose side it was good to be on, the Indians fought either with or against first the English and the French, then the French and the Americans. The Indians fought on our side in the French and Indian War, but then I think fought with the Loyalists in the American Revolution, or else I have that backwards. But the point is, trust, respect, was for sale to a point, as is ours every day. Now next slide.
The
one you just had.
The one I just had?
Yeah, what did I do?
You had it right.
I can do it in any order.
I was just going by what you were saying.
Oh, okay, fine. Yeah, that when we went to visit them at their reservation in eastern Wisconsin, all of them having moved from New York State because there was some sort of land deal in which they supposedly got better land in Wisconsin for the land they were giving up in the Hudson Valley, and of course that didn't work out well for them. Never does. Next slide. They ended up farming a reservation for their band in eastern Wisconsin. Next. This was the Mohican Indians Trail of Tears. They don't usually call it that, but one of the researchers did. They moved all the way from eastern New York to Lake Ontario, and then back to, I can't read that, whatever that is, someplace in New York. And then they moved to Indiana, and then they moved to someplace in Michigan that I can't read. And then they ended up moving all the way to an area south of Green Bay, western Green Bay. And they have a pretty good setup there now, but it still looks like an Indian reservation. It's their own land. It's the Stockbridge Muncie Reservation, or Nation, I'm sorry. But that's what they have established. Next, please. Oh, well, okay. Now, I'm glad I got at least one laugh out of this, okay? But unfortunately, this is what we hear, not only from our esteemed president, but from other folks, that she claims to have been an Indian. She can't prove it, apparently, but now she is an object of ridicule. And a lot of America thinks like that explicitly, and others don't have much use for the Indians, even up in Minnesota where I lived for a while. And there are a lot of Indians. They're still kind of the other. Oh yeah, we have Indians in Minneapolis. They mostly live around Lake and Franklin, or Lake and something, Bloomington. But they're kind of other. Most people, even in the Twin Cities, stay away from them. I had a couple of friends in college who were from the Red Lake Reservation. And one just frankly couldn't handle it and left college. The other one became a good friend of mine. And it's hard to think of her as an Indian, but in fact she was at least half blood. I'm not sure. I can't remember now. I know that one of her fathers or grandfathers was Caucasian, but the Indians, the ones who were here before we were, still aren't really well integrated in most people's minds. They become the enemy by default. Next one, please. Now, this is basically the batch of people that I was dealing with at the reservation in Wisconsin. and of course, if I say they look just like you and me, that's very racist to say. The point isn't how they look. One guy I was dealing with looked very Indian. Most of these people look very Caucasian. But they have become supposedly our friends. But they're still stuck off in a reservation. And when I was trying to find directions to the reservation entrance from the next town, the people in the bank I stopped at really didn't know exactly how you get there. They obviously didn't intermix, except that there's a casino. So, find the Indians, go to the casino and ask there. Bother me. Next, please. Now, the fearsome Stockbridge Indians have eventually anglicized, or whatever you want to say, to an extent. This is a picture from their high school volleyball team. You will find the same kind of relationship with the Meskwakis in eastern Iowa, that they're there, but they're not there. Sometimes the Meskwakis want to stay separate, sometimes they don't. But most of us seem to be very happy to let them. Now, I am proud to say, except it wasn't my doing, that Tammy's father, who was a minister, most of you know, developed a pretty close relationship with the Meskwakis. And he didn't even live all that close to them. But those relationships are still there. The question becomes what we can do to change that. There is the perception that somebody else has to be the other. There's almost nobody who can sit at the table right now and not come up with groups that they consider to be the other. They may be trying not to think of them as the other, but that's endemic in our culture. Oh, now the video.
Oh. Yep. Okay, that's not
my loyal assistant here. I'm gonna have to pull that up.
I'm just looking at this and you skipped the whole page.
I did? Or you did?
That's okay. I don't care. I will do it. I'll put it in here.
Yeah.
If I can figure out how to do it again.
Yeah.
Yeah. We got good instruction from our tech guru here, and also from Laura, but I never got around to integrating this whole thing so it works flows seamlessly.
Go off the right hand side.
Okay, there you go.
What am I supposed to do?
And now your mouse is sliding your mouse all the way to the right. It'll show up there.
Isn't that cool?
And then click on the red button.
Okay, jokey.
And the key is learning how to disagree and look at each other.
We all know America is deeply polarized along political lines. But what's the key to overcoming our disagreements? Perhaps we could just ignore the things we disagree on, out of sight, out of mind. Or maybe we should all just agree more. If we all think the same things about politics and policy, that should lead to less conflict and better outcomes, right? Wrong. Counterintuitive as it may be, the key to greater unity and more progress isn't actually to agree more or to disagree less. It's to disagree better. A lot of people today will tell you that a lack of conflict is a sign of progress. But in many cases, the truth is almost the exact opposite. I'm Arthur Brooks, author of Love Your Enemies. And in this video, I'm going to tell you why we need to have more intellectual fights if we want to build a better country. Universal agreement, or at least passive disagreement, might seem more pleasant in the short run than vigorous disagreement. But it leads to stagnation and mediocrity in the long run. It's a lively but respectful competition of ideas that fosters the dynamism and creative thinking that leads us to improve outcomes in business, in politics, and even in our friendships. So how can we disagree better? Here are three guidelines to keep in mind. Guideline number one, never try to insult someone into agreement. Trying to get someone to take your point of view by insulting their beliefs almost never works. And there's a reason why. Back in 1967, a team of psychologists found that when you insult someone for holding particular views, this induces something that's known as the boomerang effect. Rather than becoming more open to your way of thinking after being insulted, your ideological opponents double down on their original beliefs. As the researchers found, if people change their views at all, the odds are more than 3-1 that they'll become more extreme in their views. What's the practical lesson here? If you favor gun control, don't tell Second Amendment supporters that they're heartless idiots. Tell them that you think stricter regulation will accomplish a shared objective of greater safety and security. Or if you favor less government involvement in healthcare, don't call your ideological opponents Stalinists. Tell them why you think a private system will more effectively achieve a shared objective of better care for more people. You'll avoid the boomerang effect, and you might convince someone to see an issue the way that you do. Guideline number two, never assume the motives of another person. In America today, we far too readily dismiss other people's ideas. Not because the ideas are actually wrong, but because we assume the motives of the people espousing them are self-serving or even nefarious. There are two big problems with this habit. First, it dulls our capacity to reason and debate by excusing us from ever having to take on the actual merits of the argument. Imagine somebody saying, gravity is real, and being met with this response. Your argument is invalid because you work for a parachute company and have ulterior motives for opining that gravity is real. If we do the same thing with political arguments, whether about healthcare, taxes, defense, you name it, we'll never be able to determine which kinds of policies are actually best. But another reason not to assume the motives of others is that we hardly even know each other. One 2018 study found that the average Democrat believes more than 40% of Republicans make more than $250,000 a year, when in actuality, just 2.2% do. At the same time, the average Republican believes that nearly 40% of Democrats are gay or lesbian. The actual number is closer to 6%. If we don't even know these basic facts about who the people are that we supposedly disagree with, how can we tell what their motives are? The simple answer is that we can't. So next time you're in an argument, take on the other person's ideas, not the motives you suspect are behind the ideas. By engaging in good faith, you'll improve your own ability to argue for your beliefs, and you'll probably learn something from the people with whom you disagree. Number three, use your values as a gift, not as a weapon. Whether you realize it or not, what we think about politics and policy is infused with our personal values. But how we use those values is extremely important when we disagree. Think about your values like a bouquet of flowers. If you brought that bouquet to a stranger's door and gave them the flowers, showing them how beautiful they are, the stranger would probably think they're lovely and would be open to keeping them. But if instead you beat the stranger over the head with the flowers when they open the door, they almost certainly wouldn't see any value in the flowers. The flowers would be ruined, and the stranger would slam the door in your face. This is how using our values works in our conversations. The more we share them with others as something beautiful and special, we open the door for more dialogue and a chance to make progress with others. But when we weaponize our values, we neutralize their moral content. This strips them of their power and makes it less likely that the person we disagree with will listen to us. So remember the three keys to disagreeing better. Don't try to insult the other person into agreement. Don't assume the motives of another person. And use your values as a gift, not as a weapon. If you can disagree the right way, you'll help attain the best outcomes for the country. You might just make a few friends in the process. For a full guide on how to disagree better with others and contribute to a vibrant competition of ideas, pick up a copy of Love Your Enemies and visit www.arthurbrooks.com.
So, a key word in there, and this highlights part of where I'm going, either aside of or beyond Brooks, is the word assume. Every time, you know, and particularly in that particular video, he was talking about how we assume things. It's hard not to assume. We all assume everything. I assumed the coffee I put in that cup was going to be hot. I didn't take a survey. I didn't stick my finger in it. I just assumed it was going to be hot. But we tend to do that about other people, particularly in situations where we're not familiar with them, as we might be. This being church, I've got to throw in a couple Bible verses, but this pretty much says it all. And to me, loving your neighbor starts with respecting your neighbor. Or your, if you want to claim somebody's an enemy, at least respect the enemy. Try to get in their head. Do you respect the other person in relationships? Does he or she respect you? If not, what is your duty? To try, in my mind, to try. Does assuming someone else's motives or values demean and disrespect them as not just part of a group you have predetermined not to agree with? And I'll go back to the Indians for a second. When we arrived there to do the research in the tribal records that go back to beginning of writing, the people there at the library were courteous to us, but, and they were respectful, but very distrustful. What's a couple of white folks, one of whom is related to this guy in our past whom we have a social relationship with, Reverend John Sargent, what are they doing here? What are they trying to prove? Are they going to try to get over on us? Somebody suggested something recently I'd never heard of, that he said, usually if white folks show up in Indian, look through Indian records, they're trying to prove they're entitled to a cut of the money from the oil of the casino. Now, I never even thought about that, yay me. But I guess that's true. We're assuming, and they're assuming, that our motives are at least suspect, if not outright evil. As we moved on in discussing with them, I'd like to say we became friends with the librarian, who ended up giving her recipe for rhubarb cupcakes or something. She changed completely in the space of 2 hours. And also I had a wonderful conversation with a guy who, the first thing I said to him was something about I'm trying to find out more about the Native American way of thinking on this. And he said, don't call us Native Americans, we're Indians. You know, just came in. Didn't matter what I said, he was going to come at me. But after a while, we talked, and he ended up being very helpful and friendly. And he turns out to be a scholar of Algonquian languages, who happens to be a member of that tribe. But I didn't know who he was. He was just this guy who didn't seem particularly happy that I was there and was very, very suspicious of my motives. And I tried to respect him, which he didn't respect much, but we worked it out. Does assuming someone else's motives or values demean and disrespect them as not just part of a group that you have predetermined not to agree with? Let's go to 46, please. Yeah, there we go. Now, there's a tendency for us to think that Jesus was all love and light and understanding, and in the Old Testament, they beat each other with sticks a lot. Now, that seems to be true, and I'll let smarter people than I explain how we try to integrate that. But the fact is, even in the Old Testament, we come up with plenty of places where they say, love your enemy, respect your enemy, don't necessarily try to kill them. Maybe if they're killing you first, maybe. But that's all, no, it isn't beyond me. It's way beyond today. Let's go to 47. There we go. This is what he said in the video. Don't try to insult your way of victory. Well, how could you know anything? You think you're a squaw, which of course is, don't say that. That's a bad word. But that's a word that might be used by Elizabeth Warren. Don't assume her motives, which were to cheat and get a leg up by getting into Harvard or Yale, wherever it was, by claiming to be Indian. I believe that she was told by her great-greats that she had some blood, and apparently they can't prove it. And use your value as a help, not a weapon. If somebody's going to accuse her of being just one of them Indians, maybe she can come back and say, you know, the Indians had some things to teach us, and we had some things to learn from them. I mean, just as an example, that would be using her values, not as a weapon, but as a bridge. Everybody's familiar with signs of disagreement, and when you walk in and somebody just gets that look, and about all you can do is look at them like a deer in the headlights, like, oh no, they're going to disagree. You can go beyond that. You can start thinking in these terms. You can watch out for things like anger welling up, rising blood pressure, and especially judgmentalism. Judge not that ye be not judged, and I think I'm taking that horribly out of context. But it's still one everybody knows. Who is fomenting and seizing upon disagreement and respect, not listening or caring to what the other person says? And there's overreaction. Again, maybe part of the anger and judgmentalism. Take a breath. Nothing else in your daily lives when you feel that there's going to be a disagreement, which is not bad, or a fight even, take a breath. Think of some way in which you may have common ground, or some way to try to understand that person's preconceptions. There's a conception among us that we have to blame somebody. Somebody has to be to blame. Cookie jars on the ground. He did it. Well, maybe he did it, maybe he didn't. But even there, the blame is not the point. In politics, that comes out as being reactionary. And I don't mean reactionary in the sense of right-wing. I mean we instantly react to what we expect to hear. And we're ready for that disagreement. And disagreements are good. They're part of life. Peacemaking is mostly learning how to deal with disagreements. You don't always have to disagree. You're not going to. And then again, that gets us to groupthink. I think most of us know what groupthink is, but the idea is going along with the crowd. I was just listening to a thing on radio this morning about the people at a Trump rally and how they were all caught up in the moment and waving their signs and screaming their slogans, and Democrats can do the same thing. Don't get me wrong. But when you get in a group of people who think alike, or you think alike, you're going to get into a likelihood of forgetting your values, not using your values as a gift, and you're just assuming that somebody is going to be against you. Next slide, please. Oh, I messed up. That's fine. That's good, but go to the next one. I forgot to put this one in. In fact, I forgot to put all of these in. Just go ahead. Yeah.
What are you looking for?
Eventually. Go another couple. Maybe I've got it in out of order.
More verses.
Yeah, okay. There again, Old Testament. Yeah, I got some of these in out of order, but just keep going.
Oh, it's this one.
Okay. We'll come back to that, because I got a slide out of order, but I'll mention it later. So. Oh, here we go. I wasn't out of order. She wasn't out of order. I was. One of my favorite words in the English language, which is really German, is Schadenfreude. Some of you probably know that word. Is there anybody who does or doesn't or is willing to admit it? Schadenfreude is the feeling that you get when you get over on somebody. Boy, that mean kid fell in the mud. The feeling you have is Schadenfreude. Joy at their pain. Okay? And we all feel that. When you feel that, you're assuming a lot. So, respecting others is the key. What makes one worthy of respect? It can be hard. We talk about earning your respect. Maybe we need to do that, but that sidesteps the real question. Earning someone's respect is a trap, particularly if we go to the next step and say, why should I respect them? They haven't earned my respect. Well, they don't need to earn your respect. They should give them respect. This comes up all the time with our spouses. Especially, I'm going to say, teens and adult children. You know, I did that this week. Why did my daughter do that? But I tried to catch myself and say, okay, where is she coming from? It's a natural attitude, but you and God really want to do better than that. Peter writes, and this isn't in the slides, that we must respect everyone, even an evil king. Then we get to the concept of belonging. We all belong to groups. Knitting group, genealogy group, church, people on the block. We all belong to groups. And sociologists say that belonging is necessary for survival, which is the flip side of why I always I talk about why we disrespect other people. It's hardwired. We disrespect and distrust others, and somewhere in us we have to think that we're at least better than somebody. That isn't the way we think about it, but that's what it comes to in a lot of cases. In Minneapolis, the poor folks in the Powderhorn neighborhood, where a lot of the Indians live, are going to say, well, at least we're not the Indians. Okay? Somebody's got to be lower than you. That is an assumption that is hardwired into us. Try to beat that out of us. Groups have boundaries. It's part of being a group. My group stops where your group starts. I like what Groucho Marx said. He wouldn't join any club that would have him. When you get into that kind of thinking, you have a framework that sets up disagreement and distrust. And you're really framing yourself. Was that a question?
Did you talk about morality last week?
Only in passing.
Well, the chapter, you know, how can I love my enemies if they are immoral?
Yeah, I did skip the bulk of that.
Oh, I see.
No, say something.
Well, the survey showed that most young kids these days consider morality a foreign concept.
Okay. Well put. Well put. And for those of you who haven't read the book, I'm leaving out a whole bunch of stuff.
Okay.
I mean, that's not wrong. You're right to bring that up. But there's stuff I just skipped over because I'm trying to make a couple of points, not all of his points.
Well, I brought it up because there's a lot of people I know who think that Donald Trump is an immortal man.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I just was
absolutely
interested about that.
Yeah, and he's going to think that other people are immoral. I mean, just to keep things on the even, we'll talk about that later, maybe. But yes, they assume that where he's coming from is an immoral base. And maybe that's true, maybe it isn't. But if we assume it, it becomes true. Let's see. What slide's next? Do you know? Probably not. Oh, that one. Okay, all right. That's just the title slide. How to be an authoritative leader. Authoritative in this context means taking responsibility for yourself, not being authoritarian. But in this context, authoritative means you take ownership, you take authorship of your own feelings and actions. He talks in the book and in the video about the outrage industrial complex. If you watch TV or read or do, you know, taking input, you're going to find a lot of emphasis on how we should be outraged because Trump is immoral. Okay, we should be outraged. We start from outrage. What's the next one you have up in order? What number?
53.
53? Mm-hmm. Okay, I am in the right place. And then the, again, Bible says, feed your enemy, love your enemy, help your enemy. Next slide. Two commandments I shall give you. Love the Lord with all your heart and love your neighbor as yourself. We've all heard that one 1,000 times. Next slide. This is the one I was looking for earlier, apparently. Took it out of order. This guy, by the way, is not an Indian. He's a Nepali. But anyway, I really like this when I ran across this. The enemy is the one who can truly teach us to practice the virtues of compassion and tolerance. That's what we have to learn from anybody we might immediately decide is an enemy. Now, okay, the choir people or whoever have to go. Oh, I have a new lovely assistant, Vanna.
Right?
Thank you. Yeah, there aren't very many more, but I'll tell you. Go to slide 56, please. Hey, cool. Anyone who claims to love his brother, to love others but hates his brother, and I'll leave up to you who's your brother, is still in darkness. I think that's part of what the Dalai Lama was saying. Sometimes it's hard to see who is our brother. Don't assume somebody isn't. Try to take on the idea that everybody at least might be your brother in some way. Think about any scene you've seen in a movie about Marine Corps boot camp. You slug! Your uniform is out of order! Whatever. Okay. Now, the drill sergeant is trying to instill not respect, but fear. I suppose that can become respect, but that's not what we're talking about when we talk about loving our brother. Coercive leaders do get their visions of success and note a shallow version of leadership. So whoever we want to talk about, coercive leaders may have leadership, but they don't have respect, and that means to me they're just not getting the point. Leadership means bringing people into understanding, and my favorite word, maybe, peacemaking. Leadership can be advice-seeking. Get the views of others, but don't have the view that the nice guys always win, or that they have to win, or that you're the nice guy. responsibility. Social acceptance cannot exist without exclusion. The problem of the other I'm talking about. Okay, slide 52, please. Okay, next and last topic. Being an authoritative leader, we've already slipped into that a little bit. We talked about the Operation Industrial Complex. And I'm going to skip. Oh, I think maybe I duplicated some of this. Oh, yeah, I turned page backwards. The word doesn't make any sense. When you're in a conversation with somebody, recognize their role and status. In other words, where they're coming from. If somebody seems to be ready to come at you, maybe they're distracted. Maybe you're the least of the things on their mind. Maybe that person is just plain busy and hasn't been paying attention. Maybe that person is going through a personal crisis. Maybe that person could be sick or exhausted. Or you can come up with 100 other reasons that you might think, okay, why is this person reacting like an enemy? The baked-in beliefs and experiences of the other person, starting with party politics, are key. Don't belittle, blame, and bully. Be responsible, be responsive to your perceptions and others' feelings and misgivings using and thinking of the word empathy. 57. Pray for those who mistreat you. That's going out another step, not just tolerating them, but praying for them. That can be part of the understanding of them. But praying for them is an affirmative step we can take toward peacemaking. In our personal lives, we can be authoritative leaders. We can take responsibility and not be passive about relationships. Think about the kids in the back seat who hear, "He touched me!" And the other one's going to say, "She started it!" Okay, I mean, we've all been kids once, I think. And we can take responsibility for those feelings that well up with, "He started me! He started it!" Say no instantly in your mind. Be ready to say no to those who attack you and blame you. Don't sustain those who would be king over you by enabling you. Slide 43, is that next? Yeah, okay. This is a cartoon I found on the internet, of course. I don't spend all my time on the net, but I try to gather up things that inspire and intrigue me. I don't know how much of you can read. How much you can read by this. It says, how many of us are fighting each day to hold on something solid when inside everything feels like it's falling apart? You may not be the only one in that conversation I was hypothesizing that is not at your best. Act gently. Use your words, not as swords, because the last thing we need is another battle when we are already at war with ourselves. Now, the point we need to make here is that we need to offer an aspirational value, emphasizing unity and inspiration and taking responsibility and how we can do that. That's the end of my notes. If you want to discuss for 5 minutes, fine, or we can have coffee. But that's what I want to leave you thinking about, what I just said. How we can offer an aspirational view, emphasizing unity, inspiration, and taking responsibility.
What was the Dalai Lama's quote?
Essentially, the enemy can teach us a lot. I mean, we can go, oh yeah, he already got it, there.
The virtues of
tolerance. I phoned him and asked him for material, that's what he gave me.
The best he can come up with.
Yeah, on short notice. Class dismissed?
I'd like to flip back to an earlier comment when you were talking about Indians, and you had one that found Native American offensive. Says, "I'm an Indian." I find that interesting. And the question is, who has developed the proper label is Native American, it sounds like maybe it was not the Indians.
I suspect you're right, but I don't know. We can get into the virtues, if any, of political correctness. The virtue is that you're trying to treat people respectfully, but sometimes you can do it wrongheadedly. And I'm sure there are other people who want to be Native Americans. As a matter of fact, the Oklahoma license plates had something about Native something, I think. But yeah, some Indians want to be Indians. And maybe he wasn't, he didn't even have the support of his whole tribe, but he wanted to be an Indian. We're Indians, call us Indians, okay?
And just as a follow-up, I was raised in the Marshalltown area in the 50s, which is fairly close to Tama.
Yeah.
And the thing that I remember, my uncle took me to a powwow, and you know, so I had some contact with them. But it seems like they were so stereotyped with being alcoholic that when we thought of Indians, it was almost a drunk Indian, that the alcohol was such a strong part of the Meskwaki dilemma, plus they had no worthwhile economy. So not that I'm not in favor of gambling, but at least the gambling part for the Indians has provided not just in Meskwaki settlement, but other areas, a kind of an annual income that these people were, I mean, just in poverty over there in Tama.
It's the least we can do. Now, after the Civil War, they were going to give people 40 acres and a mule, like that was going to fix everything.
Yeah.
And that, of course, didn't fix everything. You're right.
So let me seize on that as a segue into where we're going to go next week.
Not here.
So,
this is it.
Right.
I'm just in
here. So I don't have on the agenda for us to talk specifically about the term Indian, Native American, Indigenous. There are many different terms that someone might use to describe themselves. But where we're going to go next week is to talk about some of the sort of trigger words that that get used partly as a way of not loving our enemies. You talked about, Warren, sort of the idea that wrapped up inside a word was a whole stereotype of a kind of person, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of person is like morally responsible for the negative stereotype that's thrust on them. We're going to talk, this came up in a couple of weeks ago in our conversation in here, the word socialist came up.
Yeah.
And we said, what does that word even mean? And part of the difficulty with a lot of these words is that they mean different things in different contexts, right? So we're going to spend a little bit of time trying to address some of those trigger words that are used as Brooks says, not as gifts but as weapons, and to try to sort of get back to what's underneath these words, and how can we make sense of what we say about each other and what other people say about themselves. So a term like, don't call us Native Americans, call us Indians. Certainly not everyone who is an enrolled member of that same tribe is necessarily going to agree. How do we deal with what people actually say about themselves rather than the labels that we put on other people? So that's my segue from sort of that one question, which is itself historically really complicated, into how do we deal with some of these complicated and kind of weaponized words. So that's where we'll go next week. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.